Time for us to get started. We are in Joshua chapter 17. We've got one thing from the sons of Joseph to finish up in Joshua 17 that we didn't get to last Sunday. Before we jump into that, let's go ahead and run through our map. And I figured we've got enough of the tribes on the map over the last couple of weeks that we can stretch our brains a little bit today. We're gonna list all of the tribal allotments first, and then we'll just place them on the map by number. And this is a bit of a trick question here. All right, we've got 12 items in the list. We're not asking for the 12 tribes of Israel. We're looking for the 12 allotments in Israel. And you'll remember that not every tribe gets an allotment, and one tribe gets two allotments. So I've removed some of the trick for you. But let's go ahead and see if we can list them all first. Go ahead and call them out, you know, loud and clear. What are the tribes who receive tribal allotments in Israel? All right, louder. All right, East Manasseh, which implies West Manasseh. All right, and I'm going to abbreviate pretty much all of these for the sake of time. All right, East Manasseh, West Manasseh. Loud, because I'm pretty hard of hearing up here. Reuben.
Dan.
All right, Reuben, Dan, Gad. What else?
Naphtali.
Naphtali, Judah, Ephraim. All right, who else we got? Issachar.
Benjamin.
Yeah, Benjamin. Call him Ben. Zebulun, we'll call him Zeb. Simeon is one of the tribes that does not receive an allotment. At least their allotment is different than everybody else's. They get an allotment, but it doesn't appear on a lot of our maps because of the nature of their allotment. No, Judah's a unified tribe. Let's see, who are we missing here?
Did the Gibeonites get?
No, they don't get their own tribal allotment. Oh, I know who we're missing. We're missing Asher. I'll give you that one for free. Asher. Okay. So, now we've not placed all of these on the map yet. We've not read about all of them yet. In fact, in chapter 18 and chapter 19, we're going to read about 7 of them. But we have heard most of these already. We've heard, even the ones that we've not seen exactly what their allotment is, we know where they are because of what we've read for the allotment for West Manasseh. Let's go ahead and place these on the map real quick. All right, we'll start east of the Jordan, and we'll go north to south. This big red one, what is it? East Manasseh. All right, this green one east of the Jordan, just south of West Manasseh. It's Gad, which is number 5 here. All right, the one on the far south east of the Jordan. Remember, there's 2.5 tribes east of the Jordan, something, Gad, and East Manasseh. Reuben. Who was 3. All right, west of the Jordan, who have we read about so far? We've read about Judah. Where does Judah go? Judah's the easy one. Yeah, the big one in the far south. And that is 7. All right, and then we read about 2 more last Sunday. Ephraim and West Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. And where did they go? Yeah, the reddish one is West Manasseh. And remember, Ephraim, all right, so the son, the text handles the sons of Joseph as though they were one tribe. We're about to see why in just a second. Even though they're technically 2 tribes and they receive a total of 3 big allotments, the text treats them as one tribe. And west of the Jordan, the sons of Joseph border each other. All right, so Ephraim is immediately to the south of West Manasseh. And Ephraim's number 8. All right, so we will start with that. Oh, we also learned when we were reading about West Manasseh, we learned of the territorial allotment for the tribe north of Manasseh and the tribe east of Manasseh. Y'all remember which tribes those were? One of them was Asher. That was the northern one. So that one's right here. And the other, do we remember what the other one was? It was Issachar. Issachar is to the, again, we have to use the word east accommodatively, but that's what the text tells us. It is east of Manasseh. All right, so that leaves us with just a couple of territorial holdings. Let's see, the last thing we need to remember is that there are tribes not on this list. There's Simeon, as we've already said. Their allotment is a little different. It's a little wonky, as we will see in the text. And of course, what was the other tribe that received no territorial allotment in Israel? Levi. All right, they are a special case. And we will see them later in the book receive cities in Israel. All right, so Joshua chapter 17, verse 14. I want us to quickly reread that last bit of the chapter. And this is where we're going to see why, up to this point in the allotment, the text has treated the sons of Joseph as though they were one people, one tribe, instead of treating them as two tribes. Then the people of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given me but one lot and one portion as an inheritance, although I'm a numerous people, since all along the Lord has blessed me?" And Joshua said to them, "If you are a numerous people, go up by yourselves to the forest, and there clear ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you." The people of Joseph said, "The hill country is not enough for us. Yet all the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron, both those of Bethshan and its villages, and those in the valley of Jezreel." Then Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, "You're a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one allotment only, but the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it and possess it to its farthest borders. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong." All right, so this last little story dealing with the sons of Joseph, it's kind of baffling whenever you first come to it. And I think it's meant to be a little baffling because we have just read about all of the territory that the sons of Joseph received. In fact, in going over West Manasseh, the text reminds us of all of the territory that East Manasseh also has. All right, so they've got this big chunk of land, half of Gilead and the former kingdom of Bashan, all to the east of the Jordan. West Manasseh has a sizable chunk of territory west of the Jordan. Ephraim has a sizable and pretty rich country along with them. They have received, possibly, it depends on how far south you scale Judah. The sons of Joseph have received possibly the most land out of anybody in Israel. Again, with the possible exception of Judah. And yet, they come to Joshua and they complain, "Why have you only given us one lot?" All right, that complaint just sounds kind of absurd on the face of it, right? Because we've just read about multiple allotments made to them. The text even broke it down into the number of clans. So you've got 2 clans east of the river, 10 clans west of the river, and that's just for Manasseh. And now all of a sudden they're coming to Joshua saying, "Why have you given me one lot?" All right, so this is the reason why the text has treated them as a single people up to this point, by the way, because they're coming to Joshua and acting as though they have been treated as one people, when in fact they are more than one people, and they have received 2 little land, 1 lot and 1 portion. "We don't have enough room." Now, we get the sense here that the complaint that they bring to Joshua is not really the problem. Right? Their complaint is, you have given us too little land. Joshua, in his answers to Manasseh and Ephraim, Joshua, I think, suggests to us what the real problem is. All right, so first off, what has Joshua told the sons of Joseph that they need to do to inherit their land? Clear the forests and drive out the Canaanites. Those are the two things they need to do. Oh, you don't think you have enough land? Give you a ton of forests. Cut some of it down. Clear some of the land. Which is... I mean, it's hard work. That's the main thing. And I think we're touching on the real issue here. The sons of Joseph come to Joshua and say, you've given us too little land. What really motivates that is they have a whole lot of work to do. Now, does that make them different than anybody else? Think about every story of any kind of settlers that you have ever heard. You think about stories about American settlers. What did every single American settler have to do when he went out and staked his claim? He had to clear the land, right? Think of all those stories you read about, like Little House on the Prairie and stuff, right? Think back to those days. This is just normal stuff. You go into a wilderness area and you expect to live on the land, you've got to clear some of it. That's just what you have to do. And the sons of Joseph are coming and they're saying, oh, you've not given us enough land. And Joshua's telling them, no, just go do the work. All right, quit being lazy, clear the land. And then what's the other excuse that they come up with? All right, they say that they are confined to the hill country in verse 16. The hill country's not enough for us. Of course, the hill country they've been given is a relatively small portion. Most of their territory is plains. But what's the problem with the plains, according to the sons of Joseph in verse 16? Yeah, you've got Canaanites with chariots. And we've talked about how dominant chariots were in antiquity. How they're basically, the modern equivalent would be something like an aircraft carrier, right? Somebody who rolls in with an aircraft carrier has supremacy, right? And that's just it. An army in antiquity that has chariots and that can deploy them out on a relatively flat place like a plane, they're going to do a lot of damage. But we have also already read about Israel defeating chariots during the northern campaign. All right, what this should remind us of, when was the last time that we heard about Israelites looking at their inheritance and complaining that the people who live there are too strong and they're surely going to kill us if we go in? Right? This is supposed to ring some alarm bells for us, because this sounds exactly like the way that Israel was talking when they were out in the wilderness and they first refused to go up into the promised land. Oh, this place is full of giants. They're going to kill us all. They're going to kill our kids. And now they've come in. They've essentially conquered the land at this point. Some of them are already settling into the land. And now we have exactly the same complaint. These Canaanites, they're too strong. They've got chariots. They're going to kill us all. We can't take the plains. And Joshua kind of takes their own words and turns them back against them. They come to Joshua and they complain, why have you given us too little land, although I am a numerous people? Right? There's too many people in my tribe for this little land. Right? Joshua turns that back around on them and says, why are you worried so much about the Canaanites? You're a numerous people. Deal with them. Right? And the whole story of this book up to this point is that, is it really up to them to defeat the Canaanites? Who's defeating the Canaanites for them? God is. Right? That's the whole story of this book. John, I saw your hand.
Before I forget, remind me, there are a lot humor the people for the land that you've given us, right?
Essentially, that's the case they're trying to make. Yeah.
And he's turning it back on them and saying, hey, there is plenty of land here.
Yes.
And if you had a little faith, you'd realize we've already, like you said, we've already beat these chariots once.
Exactly.
When God is in your corner,
yes,
you're going to beat them again. And
yes.
But throughout Scripture and living out still to this day, where the human heart is corrupt, they're whining about what they're getting. They're getting this beautiful land, the promised land.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And that fear is setting in that we can't beat these Canaanites, but we have God in our corner.
Yes, yeah.
We see this rolled over and over and over throughout Scripture.
Yeah.
I think that we would, as the gift that we have in God's Word, would learn from this as well, like be confident when we go to battle for God, that God is in our corner.
Yeah.
And that we can win that battle because we are a child of God.
Absolutely.
When I read these stories, it gives me more confidence.
Amen.
And you're seeing it here, and it just lacked that confidence.
Yeah, yeah. And while we're talking about some modern practical applications of this, remember, it's exactly like John said, that they've been given the land, right? They've not been cheated out of anything. The reason why their inheritance feels so small is because they have been unwilling to step in and do the work to receive the things that God has given them. Right? This tells us something, by the way, about God's gift giving. Right? Sometimes we have this idea in our head that a gift is something that you should not have to work for. Right? Because that's basically every experience of gift giving that we have. You know, your birthday, Christmas, you receive gifts and you didn't have to work for them, right? Maybe you gotta open up a battery case and put some batteries in something. That's not the way that we see God operating. He will give rich gifts to his people that his people then have to turn around and work for to receive. And here they are unwilling to do the work. All right. Let's go ahead and jump into chapter 18. So we've got a lot of ground that I'd like to cover. We'll see how much we get to. Chapter 18, verse 1. Then the whole congregation of the people of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The land lay subdued before them. There remained among the people of Israel 7 tribes whose inheritance had not yet been appointed. So Joshua said to the people of Israel, "How long will you put off going in to take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? Provide 3 men from each tribe, and I will send them out that they may set out and go up and down the land. They shall write a description of it with a view of their inheritances, and then come to me. They shall divide it into 7 portions. Judah shall continue in his territory on the south, and the house of Joseph shall continue in their territory on the north, and you shall describe the land in 7 divisions and bring the description here to me. And I will cast lots for you here before the Lord our God. The Levites have no portion among you, for the priesthood of the Lord is their heritage. And Gad and Reuben and half the tribe of Manasseh have received their inheritance beyond the Jordan eastward, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them." All right, so the text begins with this notice that Israel has set up the tent of meeting at Shiloh. All right, this is a pretty brief notice for what would have been a major event. Right, we see the tabernacle and the temple get set up in other places later on in Scripture, and it's a pretty big event. Here it's passed over pretty briefly. For the time being, the Lord is causing his name to dwell in Shiloh. And continuing the final thought of chapter 17, chapter 18 tells us that Israel is becoming reluctant to take the land. All right, so we just read about Ephraim and Manasseh being reluctant to go in and take their land. The other 7 tribes have been reluctant to do anything to receive an inheritance. So that Joshua chides them for taking too long. How long will you put off going in to take possession of the land? Now, here's the thing. Again, the text emphasizes to us this is not real work that Israel has to do. in any sense of having to win a victory for themselves. Right, verse 1 tells us the land lay subdued before them. Right, the conquest was made. You know, again, Ephraim and Manasseh have been complaining, oh, we got to go beat these Canaanites with their chariots. The text tells us the land is subdued before them. You know, all they have to do is go in and take it. But these seven tribes have been slow to claim their inheritance. Why have they been slow? The text doesn't tell us. We get no sense of their motive here in being slow to claim their inheritance. What we're seeing, though, is that, you know, we've had this really, really nice image of Israel in this point, you know, up to this point in the book. Israel has been eager in their faithfulness to God. Not only have they obeyed, but they've done so like quickly, immediately, eagerly, with the one exception of Achan. And now that we've gotten to this last half of the book, now we're seeing that Judah and Ephraim and Manasseh have all failed to drive all of the inhabitants out of their land. We've seen that Ephraim and Manasseh have been reluctant to even go clear their land to claim it. And now, the rest of the tribes are reluctant to even know what their inheritance is. All right, so we are watching Israel's faith, or at least our image of Israel's faith, slowly fall apart in front of us. Wayne? That's the image we're given, yeah, that they're fighting together.
So now, it seems like they're all split up.
In a sense, yes. And Judges will give us a slightly more nuanced picture of that, where some of the tribes will kind of team up with each other to help each other out. But yeah, by and large, you're right. At this point, as they're going to claim their inheritance, they are left on their own to go in and finish claiming their inheritance. Possibly, where formerly they had, you know, Joshua at their head and they had all their brothers at their backs, and now it's just them on their own and they've lost their confidence, perhaps. The text hasn't told us whether the armies have gone back or if the fighting men are still west of the river. Yeah, so the way the text is presented it is that, you know, the campaigns are done, the power of the land is essentially shattered. It's just a matter of the tribes going in to actually take possession of their inheritance and drive out the, you know, the final vestiges of whoever's there. So we're not, at least the text hasn't given us any indication at this point that the tribes should still expect to receive support from all of the other tribes, like militarily. Which I think plays into their reluctance to go in and take their inheritance. So, good.
I would understand then, because you were left on your own. Did you not get any help?
Yeah. Yeah, we've not received any indication that they're supposed to expect that at this point. Yeah. I was just about to ask about it. Go ahead.
So this is the second time. So Joshua and them have already done this, right?
Yeah.
Before they inherited the land.
Yes.
When Caleb went into the land to spy out, they come back and said, hey, some of the spies come back and said they're too big, right?
Yeah.
And so we're seeing this all over again.
That's exactly it.
But my math is messed up. Because you got the four allotments already. You got west and east Manasseh.
Uh-huh.
And you got Ephraim and Judah, right?
Yeah. So these two haven't received their allotment yet. We were just told where they end up whenever we read about West Manasseh. So we've got, the number is going to be off, though. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 up here, 5, 6, and then the one more that's missing is Simeon, because his allotment's going to be weird. But excellent point, though. The text has once again reminded us of that disastrous incident in Numbers with the spies. Right? So at the end of the last chapter, we got this reminder about the people are too strong, we can't defeat them. And now, we've got a really explicit reminder of it. Joshua says, send me 3 men from each tribe. I'm going to send you to go up and down the land and look it over and divide it out. They are on another spying mission. Right? Spying, maybe not, spying has different connotations in English than it did in Hebrew. Right? They're not spies in the sense that we think of spies. They're just going in to survey the land. Right? As the original spies were. Yeah. Yeah.
Are they all supposed to go together, or are they supposed to go separate?
That's unclear. You get the sense that this is like one big unified project where they are supposed to be dividing all of the remaining land up into 7 parts, which would imply they are probably working together, but the text doesn't make it clear.
36 men total all throughout the whole land?
Well, it's the 7 tribes that remain, so it'd be 21 men.
Yeah. 7 remain?
Yes.
Oh.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so the 7 remaining tribes that have not received their inheritance yet. So, good question. All right, so second reminder that we have received about the incident with the spies, which cues us in that, again, things are not looking great for Israel at this point. So, that is almost immediately allayed, though, by the very next thing that we read in the text. Let's return to verse 8. So the men arose and went, and Joshua charged those who went to write the description of the land, saying, go up and down in the land and write a description and return to me, and I will cast lots for you here before the Lord in Shiloh. So the men went and passed up and down in the land and wrote in a book a description of its towns, a description of it by towns in 7 divisions. Then they came to Joshua to the camp at Shiloh. And Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before the Lord. And there Joshua apportioned the land to the people of Israel, to each his portion. All right, so we've just been given a little doubt. Now at this point, the passage that we just read entirely emphasizes Israel's obedience, like we're used to seeing in the book. The men do exactly as Joshua tells them to, and then Joshua fulfills his commission from the Lord that we read about, I think way back in chapter 13. The Lord told him to cast lots for the inheritance. Joshua does that. And this, by the way, is why the text told us about the tent of meeting being set up at Shiloh. It shows us that Joshua is performing this task in the presence of the Lord. Right? And that's the whole point of casting lots, is to receive the Lord's judgment on these things. All right, so at this point at least, Israel has been hesitant, but things are still technically going according to plan. This is just something we need to keep our eyes on as we continue what is going to go on with Israel. All right, let's finish up today by reading about the inheritance for Benjamin. I think that's probably all the time that we're going to have for this morning. Next week, we will look at chapter 19, and that will cover the inheritance for the other 6 remaining tribes. 2 of them are going to be really bizarre. Simeon, we've already mentioned several times. And then the very last one they mentioned, Dan, is, once we get there, you'll see how weird it is. And when we get to the book of Judges, you're going to be scandalized. I'll just say that. One of my favorite stories in Judges. All right, so chapter 18, verse 11, for Benjamin. The lot of the tribe of the sons of Benjamin, according to its clans, came up. And the territory allotted to it fell between the people of Judah and the people of Joseph. All right, now, as we look at our map, we've got 2 allotments that fit that description. I'll go ahead and give you this one. It is the one next to the Jordan. That is Benjamin. All right, so Benjamin is immediately north of Judah, touching the Jordan River. It's in between Judah and Ephraim. The tribe that's supposed to take up this portion, again, we'll read them next week, Lord willing. All right, but let's continue on. Verse 12. On the north side, their boundary began at the Jordan. Then the boundary goes up to the shoulder north of Jericho, then up through the hill country westward, and it ends at the wilderness of Bet-Aven. From there, the boundary passes along southward in the direction of Luz to the shoulder of Luz, that is Bethel. Then the boundary goes down to Atarot Adar on the mountain that lies south of Lower Bet-Horon. Then the boundary goes in another direction, turning on the western side southward from the mountain that lies to the south, opposite Bet-Horon, and it ends at Kiryat Baal, that is Kiryat Yarim, a city belonging to the people of Judah. This forms the western side. And the southern side begins at the outskirts of Kiryat Yarim, and the boundary goes from there to Ephron, to the springs of the waters of Nephtoah. Then the boundary goes down to the border of the mountain that overlooks the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is at the north end of the valley of Rephaim. And then it then goes down the valley of Hinnom, south of the shoulder of the Jebusites, and downward to En Rogel. We should remind ourselves at this point, by the way, the Jebusites refers to Jerusalem. So it's talking about the border going south of the shoulder of the Jebusites. It's talking about the shoulder of Jerusalem. That'll become explicit in just a minute. Then it bends in a northerly direction, going on to En Shemesh, and from there it goes to Gelilot, which is opposite the ascent of Adumim. Then it goes down to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben, and passing on to the north of the shoulder of Beth Araba, it goes down to the Araba. Then the boundary passes on to the north of the shoulder of Beth Hogla, and the boundary ends at the northern bay of the Salt Sea at the south end of the Jordan. This is the southern border. The Jordan forms its boundary on the eastern side. This is the inheritance of the people of Benjamin, according to their clans, boundary by boundary all around. Now the cities of the tribe of the people of Benjamin, according to their clans, were Jericho, Bet-Hogla, Emek-Keziz, Bet-Araba, Zemaraim, Bethel, Avim, Para, Opra, Kepar Ammonai, Opni, Gibeah, 12 cities with their villages, Gibeon, Ramah, Beerot, Mizpah, Kepara, Moza, Rechem, Irpiel, Tarala, Zela, Ha'elef, Jebus, that is Jerusalem, Gibeah, and Kiryat Yarim, 14 cities with their villages. This is the inheritance of the people of Benjamin according to its clans. Sorry, did I see your hand? Did you have a question? Okay. Let's see. All right, these boundary descriptions are mostly identical with the ones that they share with Judah and with Ephraim. Their territory includes a couple of prominent places that we have read about already. Bethel is an important place. Remember, Abraham spends some time in Bethel. Jacob spends time in Bethel. In fact, it's at Bethel that Jacob receives his vision of the ladder descending from heaven. Remember that vision where he's laying on a rock and he dreams and he receives this vision? And in fact, that's probably the reason, or there's a relationship between that and why the place is called Bethel. So remember, Bethel means house of God. So Benjamin has Bethel. Notice again, they are given Jerusalem. We normally associate Jerusalem with Judah, but that is something that over the course of Israel's history, it comes about, it changes. Here in the original inheritance, Jerusalem is counted as a Benjaminite city. Let's see, also Gibeon, that we read about in verse 25. So the Gibeonites that we have read about in the book of Joshua will live among the Benjaminites. Let's see. Oh, it also includes Jericho, although remember what's special about Jericho. Are they supposed to rebuild it?
No.
What happens if you try to rebuild it?
You're cursed.
Yeah, you're cursed. And the curse is God kills your kids, in short. All right, so the ruins of Jericho are in the midst of Benjamin. Not that there's anything that they should do about it. We also, and we'll just note this now, and I think I'll remind us of it again next Sunday. We read of a city in verse 25 called Ramah. Over the next chapter or two, we're going to see a lot of places named Ramah. You've got one here in Benjamin. There's one in Simeon. There's one in Asher. There's possibly another one in Naphtali, although that might be the same one as the one in Asher. And the reason why we see so many Ramahs is that Ramah means high place. And there happen to be a lot of high places because Israel is a hilly country. Although that phrase high place, at least to us, reading back in the Old Testament, what does that immediately conjure to mind?
Idolatry.
It is a, and I think we're supposed to read it this way as an indication that, wait a minute, there's an awful lot of places in Israel called high place for a nation that's not supposed to have any idols, right? It's like a lot of the Baal names that we have seen. Ramah, again, it's kind of the ancient equivalent of Springfield. You know, like everybody has a Springfield, like 50 Springfields in this country. Although, again, it carries that religious connotation that Springfield doesn't. All right, well, that does us for this week. We will jump into chapter 19 next week. Thank you so much for your questions and comments and your kind attention this morning.